question of retiring, I suppose, in all through my life in the Stock Exchange, it never entered my mind. It wasn't on the agenda at all. I mean, I used to love coming to work. Saturdays and Sundays always seemed to be a nuisance because they interfered with my city life. But it was quite stimulating to get in on a Monday morning, perhaps with not a lot to look forward to, and you got on with making money, I suppose, and enjoying the company. And the thought of retiring, I don't think it ever entered my head until the times were changing. And I mean, they were still beneficial, really, from the partners. Our profits have been climbing very, very steadily, right from the mid 70s, right the way through to the mid 80s. So it wasn't as if we were selling out because it wasn't profitable.
When had your father retired?
Father actually died in, he came off the partnership list, I think, in sort of about 1980, and he died about 2 years later. Mm. Never been ill in his life, and suddenly taken ill, and he died 3 days later after a serious heart attack. So he was a sad loss, really, because he was a great character in the Stock Exchange, very well respected. In fact, well, I often say I still consult with him when I go up the cemetery and tell him how things are going. And senior partner Schrader got horrified about this. He thought I was really was talking to the dead.
So when your father came off the partnership list, who became senior partner?
I was the senior partner for a short while. And then it looked right for me to retire from the partnership list because we were having cessations in our partnership, which did have certain tax benefits. And then it was discovered that I could cease to be senior partner but still be a partner with the firm on paper. And it seemed in those days that you could be a partner on paper for the Stock Exchange purposes, but you didn't receive a proportion of the profits. So from the taxman's point of view, you were a non-partner. It was a most peculiar situation, but of course in the Stock Exchange eyes, you were still liable for all the liabilities. So I ceased to become the senior partner because it looked as though I was going to do an early retirement, which suited us all tax-wise, and in fact I did a U-turn. Some people have said I've retired more times than Frank Sinatra, which is it's a bit unkind, but anyway, that was really, I suppose, that sowed the seed of actual retirement, really. But and then Brother John took over, which was actually, I think, a good idea because he got some young ideas, and then with the computer world situation coming in, he was probably the fellow to do it. Mm. He'd studied it and accepted it and trusted it, so he was probably a better man than I was.
Mm. And what happened to the firm?
We carried on trading. Our profits didn't get any better or worse other than the trend that we were experiencing. Mm. It's rather strange when I look back. All the changes, I don't think I noticed any of the changes, and I don't think anybody dealing with us did. We were just Jennings and Son. Mm. They were trading with the firm, and I don't think they ever thought, well, Father's retired, there's a weakness, or Tony's no longer a senior partner, you know, we ought to be a bit wary. I think things just rolled on. We were a bit complacent, really.
What happened at the time of Big Bang, then?
That was quite horrific, that was. We were, like most firms, we were running quite large books, and I think in the first month, I think we lost about £7 million, I think, which was a very accurate and true figure. We got most of it back again, but it was a very, very harrowing time, really. Because it doesn't matter how poker-faced you are, even though you're not trading face-to-face, it still affects you in everything you do. And I think we did recover our attitudes, I think, 6 months or so afterwards, and we got back into the trading game. But I think by then the stuffing had really been knocked out of the market. I think this was, I don't know that it caused other people's attitudes to change, but it certainly didn't make the trading any better. Mm. I think people got more cautious after that. Mm. Particularly, you know, if you've got third line stocks and unmarketable, they just became more unmarketable. Mm. suddenly just people realised that the icing on the cake was, you know, was a dangerous thing, really. And I think the confidence really went sideways then. And it was a pity, really, because at that sort of time, people were just building up on the third market. All the new companies were coming to the market, and it was all very exciting times. And typical of stock exchange, there's no sure thing as a profit. There's always, I always used to say, the unknown factor that can come along and wallop.
And so did the firm stay independent, or were they eventually acquired?
We stayed independent right up to October 86. I think it took us a short year, I think, for all the negotiations to happen. And that's when it actually happened. In fact, I don't think we lasted quite the 3 years. I think it was almost to the day that we ceased trading, actually, from the time we were taken over.
And who took you over?
Guinness Peak took us over, which was that we were then transferred to Guinness Marn after all the internal changes there. But when Alistair Morton went, who's now in charge of the Channel Tunnel, he was our governor in a sense in those days. Although I must confess, nobody ever interfered with us at the bank, I think because they probably didn't understand what we were doing. And market making is very much a people's business, and there's not always an explanation why you did a certain bargain or you didn't do it. I think it's just a feel that you have. But we obviously didn't get it right. We didn't suit the new people that had come in, and I think they just decided, like other owners of market makers, that they had enough. And you know, it wasn't what they thought it was. Well, in the first year we were there, we made some tremendous profits for them. I mean, we were the largest profit making section in the bank. Just that we unfortunately gave it all away again.
Well, let's go back again in time to before 1986. You described the stock exchange when you started on the floor as a blue button, as a place where there was occasional group singing and pranks and so on. Did that change?
Oh yes, dramatically.
Can you describe?
Yeah, I think what changed it. We went from when the stock exchange was being pulled down, we had a temporary market, and we were rehoused in another part of the building on the same site. And I think this totally changed the character, because we were all split up. We weren't on the same floor. In the old market, you could almost stand in any part of the floor and you could survey the whole scene. But when the market got split up, I think people seemed to disappear and you didn't sort of recognise it. And one of the important things at that particular time, Wed Durlacher's, they elected to have their pitch on one long wall. And they were probably the first time that the market wasn't in a zone. It wasn't in a market as we knew it. And they couldn't see what the other market makers were doing, because in the early days, you'd get the type of jobber that would come in and decide that I'm going to call the market easier, and he'd mark everything down in red. And then perhaps Smith Brothers or Pinchin would look at this and think, oh, he thinks things are easier, I'll mark them down. So you did have characters that were influencing the market at 9:30. They haven't even seen a broker yet. They haven't even seen a trader. And just because he feels a bit liverish, he might want to mark the market down. So it was this gut feeling of market making. But when we went in this temporary market, Wed had their back to the whole of the market. And I think this was at a time when we had the most stable markets that I think Stock Exchange ever had. Because people couldn't see what they were making, and they couldn't see what other people were making, and they got fed up with saying there's a backwardation or there's choice prices, they used to get quite rude and say, look, that's what we're making, do you want to trade or do you want to not trade? And I think because they weren't overlooked and they weren't overlooking the market, I think, looking back, I think this was the most stable time we ever had in there. The truest markets we had. Prices didn't change unless you traded, which is, I think, a lot different to, you know, what happens now.
What was a backwardation?
A backwardation, whereas one jobber is bidding more than another jobber is offering them at. So if they were a pound offered in one place and 21 shillings, I'm going old money now, aren't I? 21 shillings bid, there's a shilling back, and you were not allowed to deal on a backwardation. The choice price was buying and selling at the same price. Now, when you say you can't, the old again, we're back to the authorised clerk's examination or unauthorised clerk's examination. You would then ask if you found a backwardation, what would you do? You say, well, I would tell the jobber. And what would you expect him to do? You say, to change the price to choice price and deal in a marketable amount. But in fact, there's nothing to stop the jobber dealing on a backwardation. If he says, well, you know, that's what I'm offering him at, you know, trade, then you trade. Which, turning the clock right back to the 40s, where there was a very strict procedure on dealing, there's one thing that you never did is what they call open another person, whether it be a jobber or a broker. And the one thing you would never say, and this has happened, you'd ask a chap the price, he'd make you the 20 to 25 pence, what is the size, and the chap would say in 10,000. The one thing this man should never say, I'll make that to you in your lot. Because if that man's got an order to deal in 1 million or 5 million shares, he'll say, right, I will sell you. And then the chap says, well, I didn't really mean you to say it. I didn't mean that. And he said, well, I'm sorry, you've traded. And there were instances in the old days when people actually had to put bargains down, really sizable bargains that they didn't really want to. So you never opened. Same as if a chap passed you and said, oh, hello, it's getting late. Have you been to lunch yet? Thank you very much. He's offered you lunch. And this was the, are you thirsty? Or, you know, it would cost you a drink or cost you a lunch. And this was the way the business was based on. It was based on trust and not trying to open the other man on his size. And if you did, then you've got to be prepared to trade. So these were things that you had to be, you know, very cautious of. And this was quite a strict discipline in the old market.
Did this discipline change?
I think it did a bit when the screen trading came in. I think because it seemed to go out the window somewhere along the line. And because it was only the old guard that probably knew this conversation, this type of procedure.
Well, you mentioned the old guard, which probably leads me on to the question about the particular people who you have memories of or particular personalities that you'd mention.
There's one, most people talk about members as being the old characters, but I just recollect on Stand 6, there was a waiter on there called Churchill, and he actually looked like Churchill. And I can visualise him now. Because from my picture I could see most of the other ones, and he actually looked like Churchill, and he was called Churchill, you know. It was so apart from members having nicknames, etc., etc., I think the famous one was Frisbee Brothers, because there was one there called the Coward. They say, is the Coward in today? And the reason was the two brothers, one had won the VC and one had won the MC. And the MC was the Coward, because he didn't get the same as his brother, so which was an actual fact. There was another one there, a chap called Lightfoot, and he had a habit when he was called to wave his handkerchief, a clean one out of his top pocket that was, and the waiter used to call out Pim Vaughan Lightfoot. And then he would repeat the Lightfoot rather in a melody way, as it were. And then all of a sudden, 400 or 500 people would take their handkerchiefs out and they would all be waving them. And that was Pim Vaughan Lightfoot, Stand 11, which was my stand, actually. So there was, they were more characters, really. And the other one was Punch Davis, who was with Vickers Da Costa. He looked like Mr. Punch. His face looked like Punch, and it was. You also got to remember in the old market, the everybody was very pro the royal family, and very pro British. And it was almost, you felt like a colonial sort of situation here. And Punch Davis was in the Gurkhas, and he, when one of the Gurkhas, the last Gurkha, I think, to win a VC, was brought into the market. He got permission, because in those days you had to get very special permission to actually walk onto the old market floor. And Punch Davis got permission to bring this Gurkha in, and he walked right the way around the floor. He walked the longest way around and out again. And he didn't come in uniform, I always remember. He wore a very smart blue suit, and he was clapped the whole way around. It was quite moving, really, that this sort of situation. Normally reserved for royalty, the Queen Mother on her birthday, or if she was a guest of the Stock Exchange Council coming for lunch, then, you know, she would walk around, do the walk around bit, which is quite common now with politicians, etc. But it was, it was quite exciting. I remember when the King died, there was a junior there, wasn't wearing a black tie, and he got really told off over this, you know, how dare you come into the market, you know, don't you realise? And the Queen's birthday, the King's birthday, the Stock Exchange choir always formed up in the gilt market and always sang the national anthem, and the whole market joined in, which was later substituted by a tape from the console bar, which didn't sort of have the same effect at all. And I don't know whether this was probably why that the Stock Exchange was so melodious. I think because there were other instances where people used to sing. It was sort of quite different.
Did that happen in the new house also?
No, not really.
So really
disappeared.
Yes,
completely disappeared. Mm. The last thing that happened, what one would probably describe as a prank, as a chap called Dodger with Phillips and Drew. He jumped in front of a train at Manningtree. It was a Royal Mail train. It wasn't going very fast, but he slowed it down to a stop because he was fed up with Francis Dodgson is the chap's name. He got fed up with no trains at Manningtree, and he wasn't arriving in the city, and he thought he would express his disapproval. Anyway, they threw the book at him, the railway book, as it were, and he finished up in court, stopping the Royal Mail train, interfering and all the rest of it. And I think the total fine was, and all his expenses, was about £1,000. And I think this was probably, time goes so quickly, 12, 14 years ago. Anyway, on the 5th of March this all happened. So a chap called Paul Downs and myself, once the case had been heard and that was the finish of it, In the new market with the podiums, I had a couple of flags made up, one green one and one red one, and we got a couple of whistles. And on the 5th of March, we used to lean out of our podium entrances and wave the flag and blow the whistle, you see. But we used to get Francis into the market on some pretext that he was wanted somewhere, and we'd get him in between us, you see, and then he would realise that it was the anniversary. And then as things progressed, I managed to acquire a couple of railway hats. And that probably was the last time that one would, if you could compare it, where that we had pranks in the market. Mm. And we used to do this at 25 past 11. And then we would go over to the greenhouse and have a couple of bottles of champagne to celebrate it. But they probably, when you look back on the... in fact, we did this at a dinner on the 12th... when did we do it? In October, I think we did it. Francis was the guest of the president of the club. There was about 500 of us, all Stock Exchange people, Stock Exchange Veterans Club. And Francis was the guest of the president. And I managed to get Paul Downs, who's now retired from WED. He came up from the country. And I took the hats and the whistles and the flags up. And we did the flag waving act, and the whole floor went mad. You know, it was a little bit of history there, which not all of them, you know, fully experienced. But it went. You know, it was it seemed to go overnight. Really, you know, the characters really disappeared.
Well, let me conclude by asking you what you thought it took to be a successful jobber.
Well, I think you had to have a natural trading ability, I think, really. And I think an important thing was a personality. I think this is... I think that's probably the second thing. And I think also you had to be... very even, an even character all the way through. People that flared up and bawled and shouted and got upset when bargains had gone wrong. I think these people didn't do so quite so well. And I think the other thing that was most important is about 90% luck. It's everybody says it's skill and all the rest of it, but I there was a lot of luck attached to it. The night you went early and you missed the cellar, and the profits came out the following morning that were 50% down, and you could quite easily have bought that stock before you went home that night. So I think it was. But then again, as somebody said to me the other day, you make your own luck. So probably that was what it was all about. And I think that was all the way through. I think all the aggressive characters all disappeared. You know, without naming them, I can think of about six people that had a very aggressive attitude towards their brokers. And when the firm shut down and they looked around, nobody was interested in them. And as I used to say to my boys, I said, look, we're the shop on the corner. We're shopkeepers. If people come into your shop and you're rude to them, they won't come back again. So we're here to give a service, and give a service as good as possible, and be yourself as well. I think that's another important thing. If you build up your own friends in that sort of area. Something I can recollect going right back to when I first went in the market was always struck me as rather amusing, actually. There was a notice pinned on the board. It said, Rule 17B, the throwing of paper balls and other missiles strictly prohibited, which of course was completely ignored, because any newspaper after 1 o'clock was fair game for a paper ball through the middle of it, or even to set it alight. So those are the things I think we miss eventually.
I think we'll finish there. Thank you very much.